morning. So, I'll get your attention, maybe. So in the interval between the end of the discussion, this last unit on issues around truth and reconciliation, etc., and before the question of reconciliation or sovereignty, which is the fourth unit, I'm calling this a midway review, though by all intents and purposes, we're probably at the three-quarter mark. But we're kind of midway. To a certain extent, what we've been doing to this point brings us to really just the starting point of the discussion in terms of these kinds of issues. The units up until now have covered background issues, key points, information that's required to really grapple with some of the contemporary questions of what actually do we do now. So today I'm going to do a bit of an overview of some of the key points that I think are important. So hopefully you can see the kind of what I call narrative arc of the course material. Very often when one looks at a course from the outset of the beginning, from the student's perspective, you see a range of potentially connected but often disjointed pieces of information. You're not quite sure how they all fit together. And sometimes you end the course and you're still not quite sure how they are all supposed to fit together. Of course, from this side of the table, we always feel we have a clear idea of where we're starting, how we're moving through, and where we are ending. But at times, I think it's useful to try to articulate that, because, of course, what I see as the structural sort of arc of the course isn't necessarily what you would see. But I'm doing this because I think there are some points that I want to emphasize and to leave, in a sense, to sort of as part of a foundation. Another note, just as an aside, I had an opportunity yesterday to see a talk by a job candidate in First Nations Studies and Geography, a woman called Sarah Hunt, speaking about colonialism and violence, in particular as it relates to Indigenous women and girls. And it was a particularly, I think, insightful talk that describes the ways in which violence, which we've been looking at in terms of Eden Robertson's book and the Truth and Indignation book, the way in which violence becomes normalized as an everyday fact. And what we need to do is to transform that normalization into a notion of an exceptionalism, i.e. that there's something wrong with it. It's an exceptional and it's an unnatural aspect. And so much of her work she spent before she did her PhD at SFU in geography, she worked for about 10 years as a community-based researcher and anti-violence community worker. And so she was looking at both the theoretical and the practical aspects. I would strongly urge people to take a look, track down her work. It's fairly accessible, readable. It's not ornately embellished in a lot of imponderable theoretical frameworks. Clearly, it's highly theorized. But as opposed to some work which, in a sense, hides its practicality behind a veil of theoretical elaboration, I think Hunt's work is quite clear and precise and is really speaks to both the unit that we have done, we've gone forward, and for some of the issues we'll talk about going forward. She's easily found. She has one of these academic EDU sites, whatever they call it. I forget the actual acronym. But if you just put her name, Sarah Hunt, Geography, or Sarah Hunt SFU, into a Google search, she'll pop right up very quickly, highly ranked on that. So I wanted to mention that because very often there are these kinds of talks and things around, but they're often hard to find. They're not necessarily well announced or connected, and it's more by circumstance that sometimes the one will find these. So I'll stop with that, and we'll move forward in this particular. So you'll remember this slide from a way back. I'm not going to go over it or anything. This is when we really began, I provided some of the geographic and social structural differences. This is what you might have seen as the classic anthropological model of looking at indigenous peoples in British Columbia. Some variations in the distant past of this course would have spent the entire time working through this particular kind of outline to cover the material. I think it's important to have an understanding of the different types of social organization that indigenous communities had prior to European arrival in this place, but it shouldn't be the be-all and end-all of any kind of understanding of the situation. Yeah, I think it's these issues become important in the context of contemporary rights and title struggles. They become relevant from an intellectual curiosity perspective. They help explain to a certain extent how certain communities integrated and articulated to the contemporary industrial economy differently. It helps explain some of that. But it really no longer speaks to the contemporary realities of indigenous peoples in which two-thirds of our communities actually live in urban spaces. And the connections to home are maintained through family networks, visits, returns, the flow of goods, like food of different sorts, family gatherings, key cultural events, but by and large, two-thirds of our communities actually live in the urban centers now. And so from this kind of model becomes more of an historical perspective than it actually is one of the kind of contemporary reality. And it has some kinds of problems, which when we talked about this, I didn't actually go into the kind of problems. If we were to go forward and study beyond this course, one of the things we'd look at is some of the difficulties and models such as this have in terms of structuring and freezing indigenous communities into a kind of social amber. So for example, the macaw whale hunting is again emerging as a possibility, and all the rhetoric around that suggests macaw should only hunt whales from a canoe with a spear. The possibility of using high-speed aluminum craft with high-powered rifles sends shivers of horror through certain components of the colonial society. That's a form of locking things in amber. I suppose it would be okay if, for example, French agriculture was criticized for using modern techniques and cattle were no longer sleeping in the same houses as Breton peasants. And if we thought that that should be the model, that Breton peasants should sleep with their cattle like they used to 100 years ago, then maybe there'd be some grounding for critiquing macaw for hunting with high-powered rifles. But that's my kind of rather positional take on the matter. We talked about the arrival, that moment of arrival. Though one of the ideas that I want to emphasize or think about in this notion of arrival and encounter is to switch this direction. So here we have a Simpson artist rendering of the meeting between Savan and James Colnett on the southern shores of Banks Island around 1780-something. I forget the specific dates. In the late 1700s. Very often this story is told in the history books, no matter whether it's in Catlin territory, in Haida territory, in Salish territory, it's told as these group of explorers, sailing forth into the great unknown and discovering new things, new people, new places, new opportunities. And with this narrative and looking at this discussion, this idea of standing on the shore of Saban is to transform that, to twist that around, actually see it the other way, not to see the discovery of something new, something empty, something waiting to be realized and fully developed through the investment of European-style labor and capital, but rather to see one standing in the flow of millennia of intellectual, cultural, and historical traditions, in which part of this encounter was from the indigenous community trying to make sense of who these new people were. Were they real people? Were they connected in social networks? Were they some kind of supernatural being, some being that didn't fit? What happens when they acted in a way that was contradictory to the way real people acted? Yet, and simultaneously, they knew, they looked that they were real, but they also had powers and capacities that went beyond what real people had. There is, in a sense, a kind of indigenous anthropology, though of course to use the phrase anthropology is to use a word that emerges fully out of the colonial expansion of Europe across the world. Anthropology is only possible as intellectual discipline in that flowing out of a particular space and through the process of colonialism. Doesn't mean anthropology is wedded to a colonial practice, but it emerges from that. So it's a kind of oxymoron for me to say an indigenous anthropology. But what I'm pointing to is that in that experience of encounter, that particular moment of exploration, that in the same way Colinet was trying to figure out what he was looking at, so too were Saban and Kakatla and other indigenous communities seeing newcomers come ashore, trying to make sense of what these brief, and they were very fleeting and brief encounters initially, what they might foretell. Of course, what they led to was colonialism and resource appropriation. That the whole purpose of this expansionary move out, in particular the absorption and the incorporation of the Pacific Northwest from the Columbia River all the way up to, into Southeast Alaska, that whole incorporation of this large area into the global capitalist economy was about expropriating resources and expropriating them at a cheaper price than they necessarily were worth. So by taking control and expropriating, in a sense, it's the term, Glenn Coulthard has used this in his book, Redskins, White Masks, and we'll talk about this. He's borrowing from Karl Marx, the term of primitive accumulation. The idea, essentially, to put it in the very simplistic terms of stealing from somebody and make your own profits, but primitive accumulation in the classic capitalist model is expropriating workers' time. You steal the time from people. In a colonial setting, primitive accumulation is dispossessing, stealing people's space, their place, their land. And so in the colonial context, this is about taking the land which contains the resources. Now, it isn't a one-way street. And we talked about the idea of the indigenous economy lying as the foundation place for the industrial economy that emerged in British Columbia. This is important because, especially in when you take a look at the early period of time, it doesn't matter which colonial place you're at, these kind of colonial expansions, it's always tenuous. The outcome is not guaranteed or certain. There's some ambiguity, and very often it requires a certain kind of pressure from the colonial power, typically through physical force of some sort. And there were the gunships running up and down BC coast. There were occasions in which villages were shelled and flattened. We don't really hear much about this in the history books. They don't look quite as extravagant as some of the encounters in other parts of the globe were, but this same practice was still used. But they also required some kind of cooperation. Because for all of these industrial resource extraction industries, including some of the early mining, relied heavily upon indigenous labor power. So starting with the fur trade, moving through to the development of the industrial resource extraction economy, there has almost always been a major indigenous labor force. And in fact, it's only really been since around the 1970s or 80s that we've actually seen the rise of massive structural unemployment in indigenous communities. And we haven't really talked much about that, but the underlying cause of that has been some of the transformations in the structure of the natural resource economy, where it's moved from a reliance on labor power to a higher reliance upon mechanization and machine production in the manufacturing and extraction sectors. And so in the past, where a site might require, say, 500 people, today they might only require 100 people to work. And in that contraction of the labor, you've seen the impact of systemic racism at play, where indigenous people have become progressively excluded. Of course, progressive is a funny word to use in this context. But if you use the metaphor, the idea of progressively excluded from the actual engagement in the industrial economy. We talked about Kitson Kalem on the north coast of British Columbia, actually it's on the interior near the town of Terrace, about 140 kilometers inland. And we referred to the late James MacDonald's paper published in American Ethnologist in the early 1990s, where he uses the rubric of dependency theory to explore how, without being physically displaced, Kitson Kalem was formally, economically, and effectively marginalized within their own territories. And this is a critical aspect, because this is one of the key mechanisms within which, within an industrial capitalist economy, that disposition and appropriation occurs. It doesn't necessarily require removing people physically. So if you go back historically to the grand enclosures in the UK and parts of Western Europe, there was a kind of physical displacement of people in that period, and part of that reorganization, first of agriculture, transforming agriculture into a capitalist enterprise, and then the development of industrial production in those places. Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations writes about this particular process. But here, with the way, when you had fully formed capitalism already in existence coming into these colonial spaces, the capacity to dispossess occurred in these formal economic lines of ownership. And one of the difficulties or problems of the modern economy, and we all face it today, is that while we might own the specific local resource that's wanted on the international marketplace, we have no control over that larger marketplace, and those effects reverberate down and compel us to act in a certain way if we want to be part of the larger market. So in an interesting way, late capitalism, as we live within, has structured our economic relations in a way that if we want to be part of the market, we're compelled to act in certain ways which lead to reducing employment, increasing reliance upon machine-based production, and accepting global pricing for goods as opposed to trying to distribute our goods locally. When we look in our move forward and look as we go forward, we're going to ask questions such as, is it possible, is it feasible to de-link from these global chains? Can we find ways of resurgence indigeneity in the local, that turns its back in some sense upon the global networks, or are we locked forever into a large-scale global capitalist economy where we have to basically act like a good neoliberal capitalist as opposed to an indigenous community member rooted in land and the ethics tied to a land-based form of production? That's a question that we will confront because there are different paths. There's arguments within an indigenous community, within indigenous leaderships and indigenous peoples over the way to go forward. We'll take a look at some of the models like Kelvin Helene has put forward, which resonates with the older models you saw in the Middle East in the colonial debates. The same things come up. So you had the one track like the former Shah of Iran, whose basic art, for some of you, this might be history you've not heard for some of you. You've probably all grown up, most of you all grown up with the kind of republic, the Islamic Republic of Iran in this particular model. But prior to that, the Shah of Iran figured he'd try to out-Western the Westerners with modernization development. And that was one particular model of development that emerged that required a kind of ruthless control of state power, the silencing of opposition, and the invitation to foreign capital to invest in building up the country's infrastructure. It had some rather deleterious after effects that hadn't been considered when they began that program, and we're witnessing it today in that region of the world. But some of the examples of indigenous-led business is the same kind, lead to the same kinds of potential problems in terms of a kind of assimilationist model through business. But it's an open question, and that needs to be discussed. I have a perspective, but we'll consider the different types of models. Now, remember, we had this discussion then about the fundamental issue, because one of the biggest studies, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about indigenous communities, African American populations in the U.S., Latino, you talk about Arab and North African populations in France, issues with the gypsies in Ireland. All these discussions that occur in these parts of the world always tend to focus on the deficit effects. What are these people lacking? It's like the Indian problem. Right? And Lutz tells us, actually, it's not an Indian problem. It's not a problem of indigenous communities. It's not a problem of the communities that have been marginalized and displaced. It's, as he very provocatively terms it, it's a white problem. Very deliberately racializing it and identifying it. And he also, beyond that, does talk about the social class dynamics. So he's not simply some postmodernist theorists or postcolonial theorists do. They simply racialize without looking at the underlying economic class dynamics. So they imply that all white people share the same particular interests and outlook. Lutz goes beneath that rather facile and simplistic approach and looks to the economic interests that are tied to ideas of cultural hegemony linked to race. So that's a kind of complex linking. He says it's not simply about a racialized perspective, but there's a clear economic underpin. And then he goes and identifies the different legal mechanisms that made a criminal hunt wild game. Because you want to control how the hunting goes. Criminal to harvest fish under indigenous rules with indigenous technologies. Why do you do that? So you can transfer resources to the capitalist class that's running, that happens to be mostly white, that's running the fishing industry. When the people who controlled Victoria, who happened to be medium-scale businesses, found that they had a tough time competing against the medium to small-scale Japanese-run fishing enterprises and the large-scale Anglo-operated large-scale corporations, the Bell Irvings on one side and the smaller salteries on the other, they introduced racialized legislation that made it illegal for Japanese companies to have access to fish licenses, and then they instituted a racial quota that increased white fishermen in the commercial fishery. And this is from 1912, an agreement between the federal government of Canada and the provincial government of British Columbia, and that policy continued right up to its most aggressive manifestation in World War II with the forced theft of Japanese property in World War II. But what Lutz points out that this is not simply racialized, but it's also a class based, and it's linked to controlling resources. So the key struggle, the key point here, is who controls these resources, who can profit from them, and that becomes what Lutz calls the white problem. So this brought us to a discussion of Eden Robinson's book and Ronald Neeson's book, both which I would say at the fundamental core approach the same issue in different ways. One is literature, using fiction, using a narrative structure of story and encounter to talk about the impact of silence, the disruption of trauma in the daily life, but also the wonder of the world in which people are living in, the multifaceted sense of that world with different aspects of the spiritual, the ecological, the social, all brought together. And then Ronald Neeson looking at the idea of reconciliation, what does that mean through Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and trying to figure out, well, first of all, how did that become possible? How did we arrive at the possibility of having something? And then to what end does that bring us? Does it actually bring us to a reconciliation or resolution? And you might recall that I suggested that at the end of the day, Neeson suggests, I think, that it probably will lead to nothing more than a symbolic reparations. And that unless we fundamentally address the underlying structural issues of colonialism, we really won't solve that problem. Now, in Monkey Beach, there is a kind of ambiguity, a possibility we're not quite so locked in. So utilizing the idiom of fiction and this world, there's a possibility of a different avenue which links a kind of reinvigoration, a revitalization, kind of funny words, a sort of a reaffirmation of a sense of indigeneity that also understands its place in the contemporary world. So there's a possibility of hope embedded within Monkey Beach that perhaps, but really in the academic book, isn't as evident. So it's not really a good place to end any kind of work, which is sort of at a down point. When you think of it, those kinds of sources, the issues looking at the reality of colonial dispossession, its legacy in violence. When I think of how Sarah Hunt the other day was talking about the normalization and the ubiquitousness, that's a funny way of putting it, just the commonness of both internal violence as well as state-sanctioned violence. So it's bad enough that one confronts the experience of violence in one's own home, but then to call the agents of the state who are supposed to enforce this and then face yet another, a further sense of displacement, disbelief, disinterest in terms of the way in which the coercive arm of the state, the police force, actually deals with ideas of personal disruption. This is a rather sort of negative point in one sense, and so one would never really want to end there because, of course, one does have to believe in some sense of potential optimism, some possibility, because otherwise, if there is no possibility of transformation through the mechanisms of education, learning, research, etc., you really are, though I have to tread lightly with Bill C-51 floating through the air, really leaves very few options to address wrongs if the ones that are spoken, negotiated, discussed, studied type resolutions aren't going to bring an end. It really does only lead the kind of back to France Fanon's notion that only through the crucible of fire can a new world really truly emerge. So by the time France Fanon was writing The Wretched of the Earth, which was ages ago here, but from his first book, White Skins, Black Skins, White Masks, through to The Wretched of the Earth, by the time he was writing that, he figured the only way was armed insurrection to actually transform both the colonial world and the colonial mentality that had been absorbed by the colonized. I would like to believe leaving aside the possibilities of any of that, we're not at the point where that actually is the case here. So now what we're going to look at are these questions of sovereignty and reconciliation. Or if I noted, actually, the course outline says sovereignty or reconciliation. Here I've been a bit more magnanimous and put and or. So maybe it's possible. One would hope it's possible to have both. One might suggest that sovereignty is not possible without some kind of political, economic, and cultural reconciliation. If it's just otherwise, how would you run two separate kind of nation states embedded one within the other? It's a difficult, just logistical problem. So what we're going to look at is how this. Yeah. Sovereignty?
Yeah.
So what is my particular definition of sovereignty? I'm not actually locking that down into a particular sort of process-based or clearly criteria reference issue. I think it's feasible to have sovereignty in some domains and not other. Sovereignty, if you think of it in its original classic kind of root of that idea, because it linked to the sovereign, the control over, if you think of the domain to be in one's own master, etc. It's potentially possible to have sovereignty or actual direct, real, meaningful control in some areas and not others. We're going to leave that open because we have to take a look at it. Because I'm not convinced that a co-management agreement between the state and a particular First Nation, for example, actually equals sovereignty. I think it more likely equals a downloading of responsibility to have the capacity to make effective decisions. So if you think of some of the different park co-management agreements where he's working, or right now in the news with the herring agreement, supposedly there's a kind of co-management consultation type relationship between First Nations, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. And the way that works is that at the end of the day, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans decides it's up to us to decide anyway, and we're going to go ahead in the west coast of Vancouver Island, we're going to go ahead in Haida Gwaii, we're going to go ahead in the central coast and Hale territory. And I'm pretty sure all three nations have taken the federal government to court. The Haida won their injunction, New Chalmers lost their injunction, and I haven't really heard what happened with Bella Bella, if they actually did do for an injunction or not, I'm not sure. But there's an example where they might suggest it's a form of sovereignty or a form of control. It's really not. So we'll explore that. So we'll look at this by trying to examine some of the documents the First Nations have created. We're going to explore, and I haven't posted those up on the Connect page yet. I've got a marine plan from Kakatla, have some traditional use studies. So we'll focus on the resource side of these kind of controls, where often there's major debates over the economics, the dollars, as well as who makes the decision. We'll explore some of the ideas about putting people around the same table and looking at the same evidence, coming to decisions, and how sometimes even when people look at the same thing, they see totally different worlds. So we'll explore this idea, and then we'll have to ask ourselves, well, what is required? So some writers have suggested, some analysts suggest, that it's making everything using an indigenous methodology, using an indigenous approach to doing something, is what counts. And that leads to a kind of decolonization and form of sovereignty. And then other writers, like Paul Nadasdy, writing a book called Hunters and Bureaucrats, suggest that while ecological knowledge is important for regulating hunting, etc., at the end of the day, it comes down to a question of power. Who makes the decision? And he suggests it's not necessarily the way the decision is made that's really relevant, it's who makes it. So that's an interesting argument which actually allows for the fact that human cultures and societies shift and change, and that we might deploy different approaches, and what counts is ultimately that power to make the decision. And then looking at reconciliation, and also we'll roll in the word recognition, which is part of this whole approach, which underlies the idea of recognition, which Glenn Coutard really critiques quite strenuously, at least as it's presented. We'll explore, what does recognition mean? And it's very much on the line. If you think of the apology that we watched a while back of Prime Minister Harper apologizing, it was infused totally with the language of recognition. Besides the fact of recognizing what Canada had done wrong, there was a recognition of Indigenous peoples. Some of the critiques, which of course Neeson suggested, it's a symbolic recognition, and then Coutard picking up this kind of argument suggests that a symbolic recognition doesn't lead anywhere except toward greater assimilation and away from the actual end goals for Indigenous communities. So we'll explore, what does that mean? What are the forms it's taking? Part of that will be examining issues of treaties, the treaty process, which is, by all accounts, a really difficult, problematic, and flaw-ridden process. If it really was meeting its ends, I think one criteria would be how many treaties have actually been signed since 1991 or 92 when the BC Treaty Commission was put into place. Can't count the Nisga Treaty, because that was already in play beforehand. Memory serves, I think we might have about 5 treaties. I could be wrong. I don't know if anyone in the room knows the specific number. 4? Oh, I was overly optimistic by 20%. 4. Yeah. So 2001, 2011. So we're at almost 25 years and 4 signed and finalized treaties. Just from a clear, crass fiscal question, that's an outrageous expenditure. There's an outrageous expenditure because there's a whole bunch of other treaty processes sitting out there that have been slowly moving along or not doing things. And, of course, the trick is, behind these things, is that each First Nation has basically mortgaged their futures against these treaties. So as they build, so there's a kind of economic process that does two things. It tends to keep First Nations tied to the treaty process, because as soon as you step out of treaty, the government demands you to start paying, demands you start paying the money back. As soon as you step out of the process. And then, of course, one of the major sticking points on a lot of these deals is settling the score on how much money is owed the government when you sign the treaty. So it actually has this deleterious effect of really prolonging the process the way it's been set up. If they really want the fiscal side not to be a barrier, they should have established some mechanism that actually wouldn't have mortgaged the future First Nations forward. Because it's an interesting idea, because they're not talking about reparations for land, property, and values removed. They're talking about compensation for giving up certain rights. And so they always phrase it more in the future than in the past. And so we'll also, when we talk about treaties, we'll ask about the question of reparation. If the wish is more, perhaps more properly, the language that should be used, the language of reparations for invasion and an illegal takeover of land, territory, and resources, or is the language of compensation as a for a few forward giving up or relinquishing of a right? And right now, the treaty model is based upon an idea of relinquishment and compensation. So that's where we're at and where we're moving toward for the end. Ideally, we'll be left with a series of possible options, and we'll examine some models for how this is currently working. And then I think at the end of the day, it always reminds me within the Tsimshianic world, the stories of moments of the past where people forgot who they were, lost the sense of place and time, and started to lose sight of the rules. In these moments of cultural malaise, there always was some kind of cataclysmic interruption and disruption of people who took a time to recover. But then as people came out of those processes and moved forward with a new resolve, with a new understanding, and I actually firmly believe we're standing in one of those moments, those great historic moments of cultural malaise and disruption where people have forgotten themselves, and it's through this kind of cataclysm of change and disruption will come a new understanding. And we'll explore some of these oral narratives that provide a sense of hope from the past about what to do forward. And that is essentially, a little bit quicker than I thought it would be, the end of where we're at in terms of the midway review of the course. And so we'll start with this unit, Sovereignty and or Reconciliation, on Friday.